Thank you for joining us again for another informative episode of Satellite Nation. Satellite Nation is a weekly call-in show geared towards the hobby side of all things television. Brought to you by Satellite Guys Radio. Now here are your hosts, Michael and Brian.
Good evening, Satellite Nation. I'm Brian Gohl, a.k.a. Titanium.
And I'm Michael Graves, K-E-4-E-S-T. Good evening, Satellite Nation. I got a chance to sit down with a very special guest last week, and we had an incredible interview for our Satellite Nation listeners tonight.
Yes, Bob Heil of Heil Sound shares stories about the early days of sound systems, touring, and friendships with rock and roll legends, development of revolutionary audio equipment and techniques, and recognized as producing the world's best microphones and the legendary Heil TalkBox. Now, Bob was a pioneer and honored as the nation's top retailer in the early days of C-band satellite. And I learned something that I never knew before. He even beta tested what's now become DirecTV.
That's very true. And he also has revolutionized the ham radio audio and has introduced a new product for aircraft communications. Now, if you happen to miss an episode of Satellite Nation, you can find a link each week over at Satellite Guys and the Satellite Guys radio forums at www.satelliteguys.us. And if you're not already a member, we'd love to have you over at Satellite Guys. Just stop by and check out the many forums at www.satelliteguys.us. Stop by today.
Now, we want to give a special thanks to Scott over at Satellite Guys Radio, and that's heard on satelliteguys.us, also on Roku and iTunes. Want to thank Dave Wallace with gotcband.com and Ralph Black, who has a show coming up right after ours on Access America, and that's also heard on Galaxy 19 KU band. Now, I'm really excited to learn more about Bob Heil and looking forward to some great stories this evening. Let's roll that interview.
Tonight we are joined by Bob Heil. Bob Heil is the owner of Heil Sound. His products are worldwide known in the entertainment industry for the best microphones in the world. Bob has been involved in everything from selling sound products to selling satellite products. Bob is also very active in amateur radio, with his own show that airs after Satellite Nation at 9 p.m. Eastern called Ham Nation. Welcome to the show, Bob, and thank you for taking time to sit down with us.
Yeah, well, it's nice to be here, and glad we could hook up here tonight, talk about our favorite subjects.
Yeah.
And that's a lot.
Oh, I know. We got a lot. Now, if I remember right, you founded Heil Sound in 1966. Can you briefly give us a story, behind-the-scenes story, you know, how the business got started with Heil Sound?
Well, I started early. I became a ham radio operator when I was 15. I'd already been playing a Hammond organ for 3 years, and two of those years professionally, I started playing in a restaurant shortly after I had my wonderful parents bought the Hammond for me. But then I became the substitute organist at the Fox Theater in St. Louis when I was 15 years old. Now, what that has to do with all of this and why it's so important is not only did I play it, but I was a substitute organist with Stan Kahn, who was the organist there. And the organ hadn't been played in 20 years. So we had to help Stan tune and voice that monster. Well, that became a very significant part of my life. I didn't realize it at the time, but I had to learn to listen. Listening is a mental process. Tuning and voicing these pipes, about 8,000 of them from 1 inch to 32 foot long. And you not only had to keep them in tune, but they had to be voiced so that the one right beside the other one would sound the same harmonically. So you had to really listen, and that was a very, very important part of my life. The other side of it was at the same time that was going on, I was into ham radio, and I got into it in the years when you built your stuff, built transmitters and antennas and all kinds of things that made things happen for you. Yeah, you could go out and buy transmitters, which I did. I still have my Harvey Wells, a 1956 Harvey Wells, and I'm on the air with it usually every morning on 3885 on AM. But I I did, those two followed me my whole career. I played for about 14, 15 years, and that was six nights a week, 4 hours a night. And, but after all of that time, I got tired of all of that playing. And in 1966, I was very fortunate. I was able to get a Hammond organ franchise, and I opened a Hammond organ store in this little town that I grew up in, Marissa, Illinois. It's a little coal mining town southeast of St. Louis, about 50 miles down in the rich coal country of southern Illinois. Well, I didn't know what was about to happen, and that I was so engrossed in the organ. I wasn't listening to contemporary music. I followed the likes of George Wright, Jesse Crawford, Lynn Larson, all of the great, great theater organists. When I opened the store, all of a sudden, a whole new light was shining upon me. And kind of the first that happened that I can remember is a guy come into the store, and he had this box, and he said, is this a music shop? And I said, yes. He said, well, you fix things? And I said, yeah, what you got? I got my Fender. I said, Fender? That's what's on the front of my car.
Right.
No, man, this is my guitar amplifier. Oh, well, I turned it upside down, and guess what I saw? A pair of 6L6s and a 5U4. That was the modulators in that Harvey Wells that I knew upside down, backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
So I figured this guy probably tried to make this thing go to 12, and it only was supposed to go to 10. Blew it up. Well, I had the parts. Ham radio operators, we don't throw much away.
Oh, no.
And 15 or 20 minutes, I had that thing humming. I had a pair of 6L6s, and you know, when those go, it's going to take the screen resistors.
Oh, yeah.
And I fixed it in no time, and he was thrilled. And he said, wow, you didn't even have one of them schematic things. No, I didn't have one of them schematic things. And he goes bouncing out the door. Well, what happened is the word started spreading, and I started fixing and building things for people like REO Speedwagon and Michael McDonald and Danny Fogelberg, Ike and Tina Turner, Chuck Berry. These are all people around St. Louis. Now, some of them were still in school. REO wasn't known by that yet. They were still playing in school. But they were coming up, and I was fixing their stuff for them. And this continued on, and I started renting Hammond organs to the promoters in St. Louis, and the major acts would come in, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and on and on and on, and it just grew. And I, as a ham radio operator, I'm looking at this technically. They were trying to fill the hall with little bitty column speakers, talking to 19,000 seat hall, and I'm going, this isn't going to work.
Well, oh, yeah.
That's all they had. So I started playing around, and my technical ability of soldering and doing things without schematics, you just did it. I built this monster PA, and the word got out, and the first thing you know, we were on tour with people like the James Gang and the Grateful Dead and ZZ Top, and I was out with ZZ Top when they didn't have any beards. I got pictures of that to prove it.
Yeah, you don't ever see them without beards.
Yeah, you know, I got a picture of that. They were great, and we're still together today. I did some early work with Kansas to help them get a mixer together so they could record Dust in the Wind, and just on and on. It was great. And then in 1971, we were tapped to do Who's Next Tour for The Who. That was a big deal. It was a big deal for music. It was a big deal for sound systems, and it certainly was a major deal for me. And we changed the world with all of this. In fact, there's an article written, and it's very, very, very truthful. There's sometimes guys write things and they're not quite up to par.
Right. No, we
but we did a really incredible concert in 1970 at the Fox. It was 71 early. The Grateful Dead had they were on a little short Midwest East Coast tour. And the first night was in New Orleans, and they played that at the warehouse, and the band left the stage and came on to St. Louis for the next day. But that their sound man, Owsley, he was had to, of course, stay back, load the equipment, load it all up, and then he was going to drive the truck up to St. Louis. Well, as he finished loading all the equipment, the DEA and the feds were there and padlocked him in the truck and took him away back to California. And the deal is that Owsley was not to be out of the state of California because he was on probation.
Uh-huh.
And the drug agent says, no, you're not going to go anywhere. So the St. Louis, and they come to wherever but the Fox Theater, my beloved Fox that I had played for so many years. And I'd gotten some speakers from them a few years earlier. The theater threw out their old Altex and got some new stuff. And I was there the day they did it. I just happened to go by. And so I took those speakers, and that was the real basis of this big PA I had built. Well, I get this call from the stagehand at the Fox, and he said, you still have those big speakers? And what'd you do with them? I said, yeah, I got them going. I put some phase linear amps and some Macintosh amps and build a mixer for it and all this. And he said, here, talk to this guy. They came into the theater a while ago, and they don't have a PA. And he handed a phone to Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead.
Ooh.
And so we took the PA up that night, and they had never played through anything that good at that time. And so they took us right out of there on tour. And there's this article it's written, and it's very truthful about it. The night rock and roll sound was born, and that was the night.
Yeah, that was.
I didn't know. I had no idea that nobody else was doing this. I was just tinkering around, having a good time.
Now, that was early 71.
Part of that had happened way before that when I got with the James Gang. I was out with the James Gang for a couple of weeks, and then we discovered something very revolutionary. Joe Walsh and I were both ham radio operators.
Yeah.
It changed our whole relationship.
Yeah, and the Indians didn't know this beforehand, right? You didn't, know each other as hams until.
No, I was hired by his management to do a couple of little shows and tours for him, and of course I'd fix their equipment after some of the shows and all that. And one day we found out we were both hams, and it changed our whole life. We've had a great relationship ever since. But that's really where it all started, with Walsh and the Who and the Grateful Dead, and it went on from there. Peter Frampton and, oh my gosh, there's dozens of groups that I really kind of helped their career, got them moving forward with big sound systems and things that really worked. Because the problem was that the electronic engineers and the technicians in those days, they'd look at the guys and, they had real long hair and sometimes some dirty jeans or whatever, old T-shirt. They weren't dressed impeccably. And these engineers, and they'd look at him and say, what is this? Well, he's got 14 gold albums and a major tour. What do you mean, what is this? I just loved it because I thought it was a really fun thing to be able to help these guys, and that's exactly what I was doing. And guess what? They were helping me to learn some of the things that needed help.
Yeah.
And that's how it all started.
Now, in all this, where did the talk box come into play?
Well, after the James Gang, Joe wanted to do his own solo act, and he had played this Rocky Mountain Way in Pete Drake's studio in Nashville a few years earlier, and Pete had a little box with a little speaker in it and a hose, and it was a kind of a talk box thing, but it wasn't very loud. For recording, it was fine.
Yeah.
But Joe said, what are we going to do about the talk box? I got this album, and it's coming up on the charts. What are we going to do? So two ham radio operators went to Heil Sound plant one afternoon and whipped out a big 250-watt JBL driver and built a combination of a low-pass, high-pass together, and we built the talk box, and it became very popular over that song. And we started building a few of them commercially. And then Peter's he had a song called Penny for Your Thoughts. I was his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And Penny called me, and she said, "Hey, I need a Christmas present for Peter." I said, "Okay." So I sent her a talk box, and you can write the rest of that history.
Yeah, that was on his album, you know, the next year, wasn't it? And everybody's heard
this.
They've heard the talk box, and
right.
Probably didn't think much about it, but that was all star you and Joe.
Well, we did almost every show that Humble Pie did in their career. As far as the PA, I had three of these monster PAs on the road at the same time. I had really wonderful crews. We had about 35 guys working for us doing all that. And, they pulled Peter out of Humble Pie and made a solo act out of him. And we, of course, did his solo act. And then we were doing the tour when he did the big double set album. So it was just, a culmination of a lot of things that happened, and there's a great piece of video on our website. There's a lot of little videos along the way, but there's one really good one that Peter and I set down a couple years ago in Nashville, and he tells you that whole story.
And that's at howlsound.com?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Just search the videos, H-E-I-L, Heil Sound. But I did that for another 15 years, and then punk rock came in, and the early 80s, and I'm going, uh-uh, nope. All my big accounts and my friends were off the road. Music kind of took a dive right then. And I said, no, I don't want to do all this. And so
sold
the sound system, got out of it. I'm sorry?
Say, it wasn't your cup of tea, was it?
No, I just didn't understand it. So I quit. And then very interesting that a few years before that happened, back in 1960, 61, I was invited by Bob Drake of the Drake Company in Dayton, Ohio, who built all kinds of ham radio receivers.
Oh, yeah.
He also built one of the first satellite receivers.
Yeah.
But Bob Drake called me and he said, "You the guy, I had put up a 128-element 2-meter antenna. This thing was a monster. It was 40 foot wide and 40 foot high, and it was crazy. I was doing moon bounce with a guy in Oklahoma from Southern Illinois. We were bouncing our signals off the moon to each other."
Yeah, there's pictures of that too on your website somewhere, ain't?
Yeah, yeah. And so,
looking at it,
you know, that was all fun. And that happened to be Bob Cooper.
Oh, yeah.
Bob Cooper was W5KHT in those days. Well, I had gotten out of ham radio for about 10, 11, 12 years along in there that I was on the road. But one night I turned my television on, and here's Tom Schneider. I love Tom Schneider. He was great.
Yeah.
Sitting there smoking a cigarette and just talking late night after Carson has signed off. One night he turned it on, and there's Cooper with a 6-foot dish, and he was telling the story about he had built this TVRO system.
Right.
And he is the guy. He's the guy that started single-handedly TVRO reception, television receive only.
Oh, yeah.
Home satellite.
Yeah, that was him.
And he would have classes. Yeah, he had classes in his backyard in Oklahoma City, and a bunch of us hams would go down there, and he'd teach us how to build LNAs and how to find a satellite 22,000 miles away. Who else but a ham could do this?
Right.
Think about this for a minute.
Right.
Who else? Who else? And Taylor Howard, another one. He was a ham. These were the guys that put all of this together. And, of course, we could be here all night talking about the fact you wouldn't have television. You wouldn't have tape recorders. You wouldn't have many, many things because they were invented by ham radio operators.
That's true.
Yes, they worked jobs doing other things, but we don't have guidelines. We don't have schematics. We have dreams.
Yeah.
We have fascinations. But most of all, we have passion, and we do things. Well, I got involved with the home satellite business, and it was amazing. I put in hundreds and hundreds. Then it became thousands and thousands throughout southern Illinois, because down in southern Illinois, they were 150 miles, maybe more, from any kind of big city. They had no television in 1980. And when you tell people that today, oh, no, they had TV. No, they didn't.
No.
They didn't have television.
That's same with me. I lived in a rural area growing up. And I didn't have – we had TV antenna, you know, before we got satellite, but we got one or two fuzzy channels, you know, because we were so far away from any transmitters.
Right. Well, that was the thing. And so I put in just thousands of those things. In 1989, Heil Sound was the satellite dealer of the year, and I was very happy about that.
Now,
that same year –
were you involved in installing them, too, or was you just selling them and hired out the installs?
Oh, yeah. As I said, I put in thousands of them.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that.
We even built our own – we had our own dishes made for us, and I used various receivers. I used a lot of Toshiba. I like Toshibas a lot. I used a lot of Drake, and KLM.
Yeah.
Why KLM? Because Mike is a friend of mine, Mike Stahl. Hello, Ken, Lou, and Mike. Mike's a ham. Mm.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I then, after I got that award, I was very proud of that. I never thought about it beforehand that we would become a that predominant, but the SBCA, Satellite Broadcasting Communications Association, were hiring me starting about 84. We'd go to the trade shows. They held four of them a year, and I would teach dealers, and these were TV dealers usually, how to find the satellite, how to put the stuff together. But in 1986, we did a very predominant show in Nashville. I was one of the first guys that put together an audio system. And I guess you look back and say, who else but somebody that had been doing the Who and Dead and all of that. But I built,
so you got
I
the
built
home
this incredible system. Yeah. And I'll never forget, Dolby had a prototype receiver with their ProLogic in it, their decoder, that took two signals and made four out of it. And they hand carried it to this convention in Nashville at the Grand Ole Opry Hotel. And I had built some really great speakers using JBL 15s, mid-range horns, 075 ring tweeters, used Macintosh amps. I mean, it was really, really something. And for that day, it was phenomenal. Nobody had ever heard that.
Oh, I bet it
I
was.
Mean, we drove that show crazy. They went nuts. And I came up with this word, home theater. A lot of people say I coined the word. I don't know if I did or not, but that was really the first time that the public, the dealers especially, ever heard a satellite system with good audio. Because up to then, we were still using the speakers and the television.
Right. Oh, yeah.
We really launched a big deal there, and it was so much fun. And then I was all over the place teaching dealers how to build home theater systems. And then we were building. I just looked at a couple of pictures. I found them tonight. I have so many pictures. We used to do a lot of home theater. And we're talking major, major, $200,000 and $300,000 rooms. We do real theaters with seats. And, of course, today that might not be much. But in 1985, oh, yeah.
All right.
And a lot of sports people, and a lot of lawyers, doctors, and Indian chiefs, because it was very expensive to do this. Because I didn't do that. This was not your $400 home theater in a box.
No, no.
This was incredible stuff. And in fact, there was another little twist of the story that's kind of interesting. Back, if we reverse the things, and remember I told you that I built this system using those speakers from the Fox.
Yeah.
And I had to build a mixer because nobody had a mixer yet in 1970. Well, I started this actually in 69. It had a little Altec mixer with four knobs on it. There was just a volume knob.
Right.
But I bought a Langevin. Langevin was a recording mixer. $10,000. And in 1970, that was a major investment for this little kid from Marissa. But I had to do it. We needed channels. We needed equalization. We needed something. Well, I bought this mixer. Well, it didn't work very well because, you know, it's very sensitive. Very sensitive. And we put the, because it was a recording board, and we put this thing on the stages, and my gosh, we did practically blow the front end out of it. One of my roadie guys, he said, you know, I got this friend of mine, and he's graduating from the University of Illinois, and it was like November or so, and he said, going to be coming out there next month, and he can't seem to get a job because it's like half year, nobody's hiring at Christmas. And he said, he might be able to help you. And because he's got had a degree in electrical engineering. So long story short, that guy came down and we worked for a month or so. And between he and I didn't want to launch into this $10,000 thing. I mean, I can fix a lot of stuff and build a lot of stuff and design a lot of stuff. But, oh, boy, that was a little bit of a big mountain to climb. I thought, I better not try this.
Right.
And that guy that helped me was Tomlinson Holman. Tomlinson Holman went on to be the guy that worked for George Lucas that came up with THX, Tomlinson Holman Experiment.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
Now, there's a lot of people that'll say, well, now, and this, the cool part of this is, and it's all part of the trivia and the fantasy of it. George Lucas's film, when he was in school, they had to make a film to graduate.
Right.
As a producer. And he did a film and he called it THX 1183, I think it was. And that, and a lot of people say, well, that's where he came with the THX audio. No, it wasn't. He hired in 82, he hired Tommy Holman. Tom had done a lot of things. I mean, he only worked for me a short month or two to help me build that make that console change. We just, all we had to do was reduce the gain on all the channels and the drivers or components and so on. But we remained friends all those years. He had a line of preamps, really luscious preamps. He built speakers. And then George knew about him and hired him to design, set up, and administer THX. And in 1985, I went to the ranch. Tommy had me come out and help them teach some classes because I was the guy doing home theater. And then, of course, I got into the THX thing. And the thing about THX is it was certified.
Right.
Every one of the systems sounded the same. That was really cool. But anyway, that was just so much of that going on in my life, and it was so much fun. And it all started because of my being able to voice a pipe organ and being able to operate a soldering iron because of my ham radio. But those were great days. And then in 91, Stanley Hubbard tapped me. Stanley Hubbard in 1986 spent $60 million, and he bought a license from the FCC, and it was a K-band license. C-band was 4 gigahertz, and the it's just like a piano. It's like a guitar. The higher the notes, the shorter the strings. The higher the frequencies, the smaller the receiving antenna, or in this case, dish.
Right.
Well, at 4 gigs, we had to have about a 10-foot dish to get any kind of good signal-to-noise ratio. However, Hubbard's family was very unique. We could be here all night talking about them if you don't know about the Hubbard family in Minneapolis. But they were something, and he was the grandchild of the Hubbard that started the whole broadcast thing up there. But anyway, he bought this K-band license. That was for what? 12 gigs. It was right. 3 times higher in frequency. The dish could be 3 times smaller.
Yep.
So what happened? He sat on that 60 mil for many years. But what happened? Why he did that? Since he was the first guy in line, he could pick the spot in the orbit that he wanted to put his satellite.
Right.
That was so important because he did it dead south so he could see both coasts.
Yeah.
And he sat on it. In 91, I became a part of the test team. I had a little 2-foot dish up in my backyard, and they would shoot test shots to me. And in 1994, I was one of the very first retail dealers the day they started selling DirecTV.
Yep.
The first year of DirecTV retail, Heil Sound outsold Sears. I mean, we were really into it.
Right.
And it was an incredible thing. That's when you had to pay $600 for your DirecTV system.
Yeah.
But as it moved along, they were going to start doing their own installs and all, and I didn't want to be a part of that, so I got out of it.
Yeah.
And I got into building ham radio stuff, microphones and all of that. But I've just had such a wonderful career with all of these different things, and it's all because of ham radio and being able to listen, understanding, mentally dissecting what you hear. That's very important.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people don't listen. They just hear. That's a physical process. Mentally dissect what you hear. Listen to every little nuance. Makes a difference.
Big difference. Now, when it went from C-band to the KU band, you know, and everything was analog, and it went over to digital when DirecTV came out in 94, what was your thoughts on that? What did you think about the, not the size of the dish, whatever, but the picture quality and the compression, and did you think it was better or worse, or what was your thoughts at the time when that came out?
Well, there was absolutely no question that it was better. The audio was better because it was digital. The picture was better. We didn't have to have those crazy dishes. And I could see a whole revolution. In fact, I got there's a picture. Oh, there's lots of pictures, but there's one picture. I was standing beside that, and they had written an article. And I made a quote to the guy that wrote the article in the paper, whatever it was. I said, someday everybody's going to be watching television via small dishes. You know what? I'm not too far away from
not
that
too
prediction
far off.
In 1991.
No. Nope.
And I tell you, as I ride through cities, I travel so much and all the many things I do, as I ride through cities and I'll go through, especially, I saw one in Albuquerque. I was there last month doing a ham radio convention, and I passed by an apartment building, and there must have been 30 DirecTV dishes all along this building. I'm going, see, told you.
Well, let's getting back to ham radio. I don't think I mentioned it, but you're K9EID. Now, you said you was inactive for, you know, a few years. What brought you back to amateur radio? And I think you said it was around 1980 or something like that.
I'd been on the road. Yeah, I'd been on the road and totally turned my focus to helping all these artists and building systems for them and doing the tours and all of that. So I used to go, I've never tasted beer, smoked a cigarette in my life and running around with all these drug addicts, but Townsend put it cool. He said, That's okay. Leave a guy alone. He's got a soldering iron and it makes it sound good, and he can drive the truck, and it did.
Designated driver.
Yes, but I loved working with all these guys, and because when they got around me, I mean, when I'd get with Jerry Garcia and I would get with Pete and I'd get with Joe, they would all behave because they got limited time with us together. So we had to make things really work, and it was wonderful. I loved it all, but this punk rock thing, I said, no, enough of that. Sold my system and quit. One day I was in it, next day I was out. But this story then is like, what am I going to do? I turned on my KWM2 one day, my Collins M2, and I'm going, what in the world happened to this audio? I'm listening, and all of a sudden I'm hearing something that sounds like this.
Going, that's exactly right.
What just happened here?
You're exactly right.
I got my new Kentwood, man. I got my new MC50. It's matching. Well, the only thing that was matching was the color.
Yeah.
It was awful sounding. And then I just couldn't believe it. So what I did is I took the little two-band EQ out of the mixer board. We built thousands of mixers back in the 70s. And some of them are still in use. We were the first ones to do electronic crossover in a mixer. And we had three-band EQ in them. We had parametric EQ in them. And on and on and on. And a lot of firsts. And I took the two-band EQ out of one of them and I put it in a little box. And I wrote an article in 1982 for QST Magazine. It got the cover award. I didn't even know they did that, but got the cover award. And I showed everybody how to do it. First thing you know, everybody's coming to me, hey, build me one of these.
Yeah, build me one of these microphones.
And so what we did is we went back, I opened that plant back up that was building mixers and speakers and amps and all that, and we started building these little EQ systems and built thousands of them. Well, then I'm going, wait a minute, we could build a microphone that would get rid of all that nonsense and have some articulation to it.
Right.
See, articulation is golden. Articulation is everything. And I learned that from all of my days on the road. And today it bugs the heck out of me. I go to these concerts and of course, you know, I don't do the sound anymore. I do the microphones, but my gosh, the sound systems are terrible. You can't understand the words. What's wrong with this picture? There again, the guys are not listening. They're not mentally dissecting. Right. They're just putting this stuff together, and the louder the better.
Yep.
No, not louder the better. The more articulate. What's the difference of an S and a F, the difference between a P and a B, all of that. And I learned that early from Paul Klipsch. Paul Klipsch taught me so much. He came and visited me, and I was with him several times. And he was the father of the folded horn. He was the father of hi-fi. He was an incredible guy. And he took me under his wing and taught me all these early things that the Bell Labs did. And if you really want to do something, you go in. It's easy today. You go to Google and see all this. In those days, we had to really hunt for it.
Right.
But what the telephone company had a very difficult time because they put the first telephone system together and they couldn't understand each other because it wasn't equalized. Your ears are not flat. Your ears are terrible. And so if you don't have any good EQ and it's not equalized right, you won't be able to understand it.
Yep.
And everything you touch today, every piece of audio from an iPhone to a whatever sound system has equalization. No, it might not have bass and treble knobs on it.
Right.
But somewhere along the way, the engineers designed the circuit, the audio circuit, to include that EQ that would make it articulate into your ears.
Right, yeah, it's in there
somewhere.
Then,
of course, we have variable EQ. Yeah, and that's what I did. I brought that to the market, to the ham radio market, and then I started building microphones with that peak in it. and it became incredibly popular. And we really busted open a whole new life for amateur radio with microphones that are articulate. Next thing you know, about 8 years ago, Joe, sitting me down at his kitchen table, said, "You got to do something for me." And I said, "What's that?" He had his Shure SM58. He said, "Your ham radio microphone," which at the time was the Gold Line. It was the largest selling microphone in the ham radio market. And he said, "Your Gold Line ham radio mic is better than my SM58. I said, "Get out of here. It can't be." I hadn't listened. When I left the market in 1980, I slammed the door.
Right.
And I never looked back. Well, in that time, Shure, Electrovoice, Sennheiser, all these guys moved to China.
Yeah.
What a ridiculous thing that is.
Oh, yeah.
This wonderful thing that was really good, designed by these genius guys. Well, those genius guys are gone.
Right.
These companies are now run by grandchildren. These grandchildren don't have a clue.
No, they just want the money a lot of times, and that's it.
And so we started working with Joe. I kid about it, but it's pretty true. Who can have the Eagles as your beta tester?
That's true.
But it was two ham radio operators. Joe was very technical.
Right.
He'd come up with an idea, and I'd build it for him, and, wow, this is pretty good. And the next thing you know, he's passing it around to all of his buddies, and we now have really really made some inroads with all kinds of technology. We have our own patterns. They're not coidioid. I don't want coidioid. I want nothing out the back. And because of that big antenna that I had to learn to phase, I was really a nut for phasing. Because how do you get rid of the carrier on your sideband rig? How do you get rid of the other sideband? How does a notch filter work? How does noise-canceling headphones work? It's all because of things in and out of phase.
Yep.
And it's so sad that the microphone companies never applied that. They tried, but they didn't do it good enough. They'll have maybe 5 or 10 dB of rear rejection. All of our microphones, including the ham radio microphones and the microphone that Carrier and Underwood, Stevie Wonder, Charlie Daniels, there's about, right now, probably 400 or 500 of them using our mics. All of those exhibit 40 dB of rear rejection. That's unheard of.
Yeah,
well,
that's a lot.
Not with Heil Sound.
Right.
That is really our big flagship, is that fact that we have no problem with feedback because we got this 40 dB of rear, and it's all because of Joe saying to me, "Remember that big antenna you had? You turned that around backwards. I couldn't hear you. You turned it to me. It was great. They couldn't hear you. Put that in my microphone."
Right.
And we figured out how to do that. And I mean, we're not engineers. We're two silly hams sitting at a kitchen table.
Right.
And I why didn't the million-dollar engineers do this? Because they don't have million-dollar engineers. One of the big engineers at Shure was a good friend of mine, and a few years ago they fired him. And I said, "Bob, why'd they do that?" He said, "They told me they don't need me anymore." Oh, boy. So all they're doing is copying what Grandpa did in 1965.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have a little better material.
Yeah.
We have a little better way of doing things.
Yep.
Technology's really moved forward.
Yeah.
Why hasn't it happened? I don't know. Well, it certainly has happened for Heil Sound. And we're very, very honored, blessed, and proud to bring new technology to the broadcast industry. And we're just blowing people away, because you would think the big lines would still be there. Well, they're there. But they don't sound good because they're now Chinese copies.
Yeah.
Kind of sad.
Yeah. And before we wrap up tonight, let's see. You've got a show, too. We've mentioned a time or two here, but you got a show called Ham Nation that comes on Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. Our show, Satellite Nation, comes on at 8 p.m. Eastern. Yours comes on 9 p.m. Eastern. Tell us a little about that show and how that got started.
Well, that's interesting. Leo Laporte, of course, is the master of making the internet work. He really has an incredible thing going with his Twit network, this week in technology. And I was living in California for about 8 to 10 years, and I did it really to be closer to Joe, and that's when we developed the Pro microphones. But I'd listen to KFI out there and the big talk show, and on the weekends, Leo is on 160 radio stations across the country.
KFI being one of them. I listen to him most every week.
Yeah, Saturday, Sundays. And one day I'm hearing this gal called in, and she's telling me how nice he is to all the listeners, and your voice just sounds so good. He rips off in about a two-minute advertisement. Now, we're on 160 radio stations. He rips off. I didn't know him. I knew of him because I listened to him. And he rips off, and no, he said, it's not me. It's my Heil PR40s. And he goes on, you know, you've seen these RE things, and you've seen these Neumann things and all that. And he said, no. He said, I've used all these microphones all my career. He said, this PR40 is the best microphone I ever used. I'm going, wait a minute. Holy smoke. So I went back and listened to the replay the next day, and I'm going, what is happening here? So I put in a call, and I got a hold of him. And he told me, he said, yeah, I won it at a podcast convention. He said, I was voted the best podcast.
Yeah, and you didn't even know he was using a Heil, I guess, at the time.
No, I didn't. And so we became good friends. He then bought many of them. He owns about 40 of them. He won't allow one of his major hosts to be on his network unless they have a PR40.
Yeah, I've noticed they all got Heil microphones.
That's because everything starts at the microphone. Yeah. And you get some of these clowns that, well, I'll just EQ my whatever, or I'll do this. And no, you won't.
Nope.
You can add all the black boxes you want. It won't sound right. It's going to be overly processed or under EQ'd. You can tell. You just know.
Yeah.
The PR40, you don't use anything. He isn't using any EQ, nothing.
Really?
And that's the wonderful thing about it. I mean, you take Carrie Underwood, 32 Heil mics on her stage, zero, nada EQ, on and on. Charlie Daniels got 35 Heil mics, none, zero EQ. Don't need it. And it's really difficult for people that have never used them. Say, well, that's not possible. Well, we got hundreds of groups out there doing it, and their engineers love it because they don't have to worry about tweaking anything because it's already done. We've already done the microphone properly.
Right.
And it's really refreshing. But that's how we got started. I went up to visit Leo then about 3 years ago. And while I was there, if you want to see a great show, you look up on his network a thing called Triangulation 8. He is a wonderful interviewer. Yeah, Triangulation 8.
Okay.
Him and Tom Merritt and myself. It was always those two guys, and they have a guest in. That's where Triangulation comes. It's really good because it just tells a whole story of a lot of things. And from there, that day, he started seeing his chat room coming in, and they didn't put their stupid little names and handles. I hate all that. What's wrong with your real name, buddy? And they started calling in with their ham radio call. And he's going, Heil, what is this?
Yeah.
Did you set all these guys up? And I said, no, you know that. I didn't even know we were going to do this show till about an hour ago. He said, they're all hams. I said, guess what? We were the original geeks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's
true. So that's how he said, you got to do a show for me. You have to do. I said, I don't have time to do this. He said, you'll find time. We need you. He said, this information's got to be out there. Well, I didn't even get out of his parking lot, and I dialed Joe Walsh, and I said, hey, Joe, because I know Joe. Joe is the guy that turned me on to him. He said, you got to listen to this guy all afternoon. He's really cool.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So I said, Joe, guess what? He's going to give us an hour to talk about ham radio. All right. I said, would you be my first guest? Well, yeah. I said, I want to ask you another question. I said, I've never asked you this in all of our 40-some years together. Would you write and play a theme song for it? And so he did. And every week you get to hear Joe with the Ham Nation theme song.
Yeah.
And the second guy I called was the one of the best supporters and the greatest teacher of amateur radio, and that's Gordon West.
Yeah.
And it just continues. We got George Thomas does a thing that I dreamed up called Smoke and Solder. Shows you how to build things.
Yeah, I love
Valerie
that.
Is a new. And have you heard Valerie, the DX
Queen? I didn't catch this week's, but I think it was last two weeks ago I caught her. Yeah, and saying she was new.
Jerry is one of the kingpins of the DXpedition dudes. He's something. But, boy, it's so refreshing to have all of these great people that do things. And that's what the show is all about building things, enjoying things, and all of that. So that's where it all comes from, just having fun with ham radio.
Yeah. You've definitely led a very interesting life, Bob. It's one a lot of people is probably envious of. But you don't seem like one of those. It's like, oh, look at me, you know. And you're out there, you're just ham radio, and you just do it, and you love it and learn from everything.
Yeah, well, it's a blessing. It really is. And, you know, one of the wildest things that happened was back in 2007 or 8, whatever, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame came to me, and they said, hey, have you got any of this stuff that you did? I didn't get it. There's so much to talk about, but after I did 2 years with Townsend and the Who with Who's Next, he called me to come and see him over in the UK. So I flew over and he said, listen, Quad Sound's big right now. This was 1973. And he said, you think you could build a PA so we could move Roger's voice around the arena? Yeah, I can do that. And so I did, and we built the first quad sound system for 20,000-seat arenas. And he said, you go – this was the thing that really got to me. When I left his house that day to come back to Marissa, Illinois, from London, he said, you go build it, and I will go finish writing it. And there the technology and the artist met. And he knew what was going to happen and finished it. And Quadrophenia is just an incredible thing. Well, a lot of that ended up in the Rock Hall because they came to me and I had a lot of the pieces. And we're very, very blessed, incredibly proud and honored to have a room. It's a huge room with on the third floor, on the technical floor, right beside Les Paul's room.
Wow.
And it's all about the different things that we did. It's got the board we did ZZ Top with, the board we did, that board I told you that Tommy Holman helped me with the Dead, that did so many groups. And then, of course, the stuff from Quadrophenia, the first talk box, the very, very first talk box. I had Joe and I had Peter sign it. Just crazy stuff like that. But when I looked at it, but you know what? After these years of visiting back to the Rock Hall, it wasn't crazy. It was a foundation that built the industry of concert sound.
Right.
And how did it all start? It started with this crazy little guy with a soldering iron, a ham radio, and it was able to voice and tune a pipe organ and listen.
Yep.
Listen to what happened when something didn't work. He could fix it. And that's, I guess, the whole story.
I got one more question for you. Is there any new products that's coming out from Howl Sound that you can talk about that you might have in the works that's not out yet? Or
yep, we've been working 2 years on this. There's a headset that's been out there for the airline pilots called David Clark. David Clark's been building these for years. They're big old crazy things that fit on your head, but oh my gosh, they're so uncomfortable and they don't sound very good. Well, I took that designed a heart. I've been 2 years working on it. We're going to have a major launch in 2 weeks. We really haven't ever launched a product like this, but we're going to. I have three people in my media team and graphics and media, social media, all that, Facebook, so on.
Right.
And it's going to be a major launch. We call it the Pro 7. And it's a headphone, but it's got 2-inch thick gel foam filled pads on it. So it's very comfortable, all adjustable up and down and in and out. It has a balance control left and right. So some people have a little hard of hearing in one ear or another.
Right.
You can balance them. And it has our exclusive. We have been doing this for years. and that is it's the only headset that has phase reversal in it. And you're going to say, why?
Yeah.
Well,
that was my next question.
I learned that from my home theater days. You can cause signals to move. How do you get a center channel and a left and a right and a rear out of two signals? You know, a lot of people don't think about that. They plug in that little red and that little white RCA plug.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. We end up with four channels. How do we do that?
Right.
Well, Ray Dolby did it for you in the processor, but how's it work? It's all about in phase and out of phase. The vocals, the center channel is out of phase from the outside channels. Well, I have a phase reversal in my headphones. And when you get in a big pile up and you got a whole bunch of guys on the same frequency talking, you flip the phase switch and they'll move them from the front of your head to the back of your head. It actually moves the acoustical platform in your brain.
Wow.
And people go, huh? Until they try it. And we've been doing it for years. But anyway, now this headset is really crazy. And we're very excited. The Pro 7 has a new microphone element in it. But the other thing I did was kind of interesting. I learned this from Paul Klipsch. The speaker, when you build a speaker cabinet, you have to know the free air cone resonance of that speaker. And then you take that and you build the box to match that resonant frequency. Because we're not talking about the frequency response. We're talking about in free air. You take it outside. You take it in somewhere that's not tuned at all. And you measure where that cone is resonant. Free air cone resonance. Then you take that and you build the box to that frequency. And your box, your speaker ends up sounding like it's in a box about three times bigger than it is. And a lot of people don't know how to do that. Paul Klipsch knew how. Paul Klipsch taught me.
Uh-huh.
And I do it to my headphones. And it really sounds great.
Well, I bet it
does. So just crazy stuff. But yeah, but the Pro 7's coming out soon. We're very excited about it.
Okay. And then anybody that's interested in your stuff, they can go to www.howlsound.com. Besides just buying stuff or looking, I guess you don't really buy there. There's a list of dealers.
But. Right. Right. We got dealers all over the world.
Like you said, the archives on there of pictures and videos and stuff. Well, Bob, I want to thank you for taking the time to sit down with us this evening. And it's been a pleasure, and it's really enjoyed having you on the show.
Well, thanks a lot. I hope we can do it again, and we'll continue on from here. Who knows what the next platform is going to be, but I can tell you one thing. It'll be fun, and I'll tell you what's at the center of whatever happens is going to be ham radio.
Wow, that was a great interview, Michael. Thanks a lot. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Tune in next week for another exciting show. The same time, the same station. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks to all that tuned in tonight. Join Satellite Guys Michael and Brian next Wednesday for another informative episode of Satellite Nation. And don't forget to like our page at facebook.com/Satellite Nation Radio. Until next week, good night.